tuned to Tidings, and I'm Hazel Kahn. It's with great pleasure that I'm introducing you to Richard Falk. He's Professor Emeritus of International Law and Practice at Princeton University and a prolific writer. In 2008, the United Nations Human Rights Council appointed him to a six-year term as United Nations Special Rapporteur, where he reported on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territories occupied since 1967. Among dozens of books, he is the author of Palestine, The Legitimacy of Hope, which is based on entries to the blog he began in celebration of his 80th birthday. Last month, he posted the following. It is entirely inappropriate for anyone to ignore the brutal dispossession of the Palestinian people, the prolonged denial of the Palestinian right of self-determination, and the horrific daily ordeal of living, as millions of Palestinians do, under occupation, in refugee camps, and in involuntary exile, decade after decade. Bad memories of victimization are never a sufficient reason to overlook crimes being committed in the present. Richard is speaking to us over Skype from California. Over the years, his bold reporting was an important source for my own education about Palestine. I was moved by his clarity, compassion, and fearless outrage, and so it's a very special honor for me to welcome him to Tidings and to WPKN. As we talk, I'm going to ask him about the special relationship between Israel and the United States, and also to help me understand how Israel has been able to sustain its Holocaust-based narrative of exceptionalism, and at the same time avoid much international criticism of its harsh occupation of Palestine. Welcome, Richard, and thank you very much for being here. Could we start with your role as UN Special Rapporteur for Palestine? I'm very interested to know what you see as you look back on those years.
Did you know that just today my successor resigned? He couldn't get cooperation that had been promised him by Israel.
Really? He was chosen as somebody who might be more acquiescent, right?
Well, both that he'd be more acquiescent, but also he had received assurances from Israel that they would cooperate with him. But as I had told him, I actually had conversations with him and warned him that if you're even 10% objective, you have to come to more or less the same conclusion.
Yes.
There is a New York Times story and a Reuters story, and lots of people have contacted me.
Yeah, I can imagine. It's a really big deal. So you did all this for 6 years, and you found that really, in one sense, it made no difference. Nobody really listened. So then, how is it possible that Israel has managed to perpetuate this image of them as the victim, whereas in fact, you know, they are anything but a victim? And then to get the compliance fee of the United States, and then there's many ways, you know, that you've talked about. So they've managed to get everybody to buy into this.
They managed to get the Beltway, Washington,
yes,
to buy into it.
And Europe, you know, is kind of hesitant. I mean, they don't come all out and say things either.
There are differences in some of the countries, but you're right. And there are complex reasons that are operative both in Europe and explanatory in the U.S. as well.
Are you talking about the Holocaust in particular?
The Holocaust is extremely important in Germany and explains the German reluctance to voice criticism, which is both a governmental reluctance and a reluctance among ordinary people. There are other reasons for other countries. For instance, Israel has very important arms, sales relationships with several of the European countries. And especially since 9/11 is seen as an expert in how you deal with quote-unquote terrorist challenges. And all of that plays into this sense that Israel plays an important role for a small country, somewhat analogous to the way Switzerland played an important role during World War II as a kind of intermediary and financial mediating presence between the Axis powers and the Allied powers. And it's quite invisible. It's not widely understood as reinforcing the obvious things such as the Israel lobby and the fact that US and Israel have some common strategic interests in the region.
Fine. Well, those are rational and geopolitical reasons.
Yes.
That could be said of any country, that those
yes.
things might apply. But there's also the special relationship between Israel and the US. There is also, have you actually lived in Israel at all?
Not lived. I've been there.
Yeah, of course, long. Of course. Yeah, I've actually lived there and my parents went there and died there and everything. But then there is also the emotional and perhaps the blackmail. I hate to use that word right now, and I should probably modify it later on. But the fact that Israel says, you know, we have to do these things. We have to security, because look at what happened to us in World War II. Mm-hmm. So that is always there in the background. It's there vis-a-vis, certainly with Germany and the US. It's always, look at what happened to the Jews, and we can't let that happen again. Never again, never yes. again, right?
Yes. It also plays into this exaggeration of threats, you know, mm-hmm. the attitude toward Iran, for instance. Mm-hmm. And I think there is a reality in Israel to this, what one might call existential fear, that's linked to this historical experience of anti-Semitism, Nazism, Holocaust, and is manipulated in a very cynical way by the right-wing leadership in Israel and to some extent by the ultra-Zionist forces in other parts of the world.
That's my point, that it is manipulated, but it's also absorbed. A school
yeah.
child will tell you yeah. the same story. And then there's the wall that's been erected as constant reminder of the threat that's behind the wall.
Yes.
And there's always military exercise, Air Force exercise. You always are surrounded by the soldiers wearing uniform and guns in the street, on the bus, in the restaurant, wherever you know
yeah.
you go. It's always there.
It's the indispensable dominant public institution.
The army.
The IDF,
yeah. But then there's also, and maybe I'm more conscious of this because I lived there, there's something in the language as well, the conversational terms. If you were ever to broach the subject and say, yeah, but what about this wall? Then they'll say there's two or three words. One is malasot. What should we do? What should we do? You know, they shrug their shoulders, they throw up their hands and they say, what should we do? Mm. Or they'll say, ein brera, there's no choice, there's no alternative. You know, what else can we do? And then it's the hamatzav, it's the situation. It's the situation. And so these three together, you know, combine into this inevitability, it's a resignation. And yet Israel is so much not a resigned society. You know, it's a very, very aggressive society. And so these answers, these terms end conversation. They're not conversation starters. It's like, you know, they're all rhetorical questions and they all have the shrug and the throwing up of the hands. So then the conversation ends and they don't introspect on this.
What you say is very interesting, but it also is in tension a little bit with what I haven't been there since 2008 when I was expelled, actually.
Mm, really?
Yes, and put in a kind of prison, the airport prison. But my impression is that the younger generation now in Israel is very post-Zionist in a sense and is rather cynical about the world and sees themselves as dominating a successful and powerful state that doesn't have to answer to any kind of international pressure and has lost the idealism that was a part of what made Israel so appealing in its early years.
But a lot of young people leave. I mean, you know, there's significant presence in New York and in Berlin,
yeah.
for sure.
And particularly of these people that valued the Israeli experience partly for its idealism, as well as, you know, either the biblical or sanctuary aspects of what created the Zionist project in the first place. You know Daniel Levy? He was a sort of prominent political figure for a while in Israel, but he left some years ago saying Israel isn't the same country it was.
Okay, there's two questions now. One is, Israel is not the same country. So then I have been thinking about Israel exceptionalism, you know, the chosen, God's chosen people, or light unto the nations. Those are exceptionalism terms, aren't they, and concepts?
Yes. I've lived with that all my life in the U.S. without any connection with Israel, but I think there's a very deep sense among people who've been raised as ethnically sensitive Jews that they are a chosen people, that there is a kind of superiority if you measure it by cultural achievement or intellectual prominence or economic success.
Yeah, how many Nobel Prize winners are Jews?
Yeah, that whole consciousness is, I think, a very dangerous thing. And of course, America has its own version of exceptionalism, which is also very dangerous in different ways.
So that's the Jewish thing. But then how does that relate to Israel? So if Israel then also considers itself exceptional, we are the only democracy in the Middle East. We're the only ones that everybody in the world hates. We're the only ones who had the Holocaust. To me, there's a sort of tremendous conflict or disparity or dissonance, I guess, between that view of themselves and who they really are, which is a militaristic nation that's a sort of fairly brutal occupier. So then I wonder, how does that then relate to the Holocaust? They say we have to protect ourselves. Now, with this really brutal occupation, where did they get these ideas from? Because, you know, they say the Nazis tried to kill us and destroy us and liquidate us. So then why are they using so many of the same strategies and tools? Let's just talk about the tools. I'm not going to say that they like the Nazis, but a lot of people have said that. So I'm not actually saying that. It's a very sophisticated occupation, and they managed to control it with technology and with ideas and with architecture and roads and license plates and different ID cards and everything. It's tightly, minutely developed to create an apartheid society.
Yes, and I think in some ways the South African comparison is more appropriate.
Yes.
Although the German Nazi experience is insightful in the sense that there is a tendency of a people that has been brutally victimized to reproduce that victimization once they get in a position of control. This is more you find in actually in German philosophy itself. A philosopher like Nietzsche, he talks about the resentment of those that are victimized makes them very dangerous once they end their victimization. It's a kind of collective feeling of, since we've been victimized, we'll victimize others. There's a kind of this reproduction of victimization. You find it also psychologically with abused children that tend to be abusive parents.
How do you go from individual experiences? How does that become a collective experience in a country like Israel?
Well, there, I think the combination of things that we are special and better, and we have always been attacked by enemies, and we perished when we were weak. Part of the
narrative, yeah.
Yes, part of the post-Holocaust narrative. Mm-hmm. When we're strong, people respect us. The only language the Arabs understand is force. You know, there are a whole series of fortifying beliefs that create a coherent ideology that has been accepted by the great majority of Israelis and their supporters overseas.
Richard Falk is talking about his experiences as UN Special Rapporteur on Palestine and the special relationship between Israel and the United States. This is Hazel Khan on Tidings on WPKN Radio.
And they're blind to the ordeal of the Palestinian. There's a kind of denial by some, a feeling that the Arabs are out to get us, and the only way we can survive is by keeping them down and keeping them in a state of fear and anxiety, demoralizing them, making them feel hopeless and despair, and crushing with overwhelming force if they do anything violent.
Those are terms that could have described the Nazis as well.
Yes, of course. And the collective, you know, the death to the Arabs, you know, which is become a quite acceptable motif in the social media in Israel. You know, the Minister of Justice, ironically enough, in Israel, I forget her name, made these genocidal comments during the 2014 attack on Gaza.
Then there's the settlements where the people there are just as angry with the Israeli army as they are with the Arabs. And that's why they do those, what are they called?
Price tags.
Price tags, yeah.
Retaliation. Of course, they play a double game because on the one side, they receive enormous support from the Israeli government. And many of the settlements are heavily subsidized and they're all protected. I mean, in Hebron, which is the most biggest flashpoint on the West Bank, there's something like 4,000 soldiers protecting 400 settlers. Right. You have a lot of complexity, all these relationships that emerge. What I think is correct is that there are a lot of people in Israel that have felt all along that the settlements are not compatible with seeking a peaceful solution. And I think now it's gotten to a point where the settlements are so large, and I mean, there's something like 600,000. That it created a irreversible reality, which I think even the anti-settlement political leaders allowed to happen.
Go back to those phrases. What should we do? We have no choice.
Yes.
It's the situation.
With the settlements, they did have a choice. And why people like Rabin and Peres and others never felt able to challenge the settlement phenomenon and what it meant for a diplomatic outcome to the conflict.
You're saying you don't know why they didn't?
No, I think there is, even among the so-called liberal elements in Israel, including those that probably sincerely would like to find a peaceful solution, there's an ambivalence about rejecting the greater Israel, the biblical vision of which would include the West Bank and all of Jerusalem. And if you once have that vision, you can't find any way of resolving the conflict except by keeping the Palestinians under control or expelling them or killing them. Those are the only alternatives that are.
Yeah, otherwise it would jeopardize the Zionist dream.
Yes. You know, I knew Peres a little bit, and even if you reject the Zionist dream, a political figure in Israel has never been willing to challenge it openly.
I have no numbers, but I imagine that Israel is, in fact, more homogeneous now, the consciousness, more homogeneous despite all the religious differences within the country. It's more homogeneous maybe than it's ever been because there just is less dissent.
Yes, there's certainly in the Jewish part of Israel, that I think the Arab part of Israel is more alienated than it was previously. But I think there is this sense that there's no point in seeking a peaceful solution at this point. Either it's unattainable or Palestinians, you know, part of the myth is the Palestinians don't really want a peaceful settlement, which in my experience is completely false.
one of the questions I really had struggled with is, what is the continuity between the Holocaust and Israel today? What is the thread that takes them today to be that kind of country? And you've explained that. So then the question is, and you use the phrase, you said, as a Jew in America, I feel the tensions of conflicting identities. And then you talked about that things have become more tribal and that the Jews have been more ethnically assertive and there's been a rise of Zionist loyalties. So then, you know, bringing that down maybe to the personal, as my father would have said in Yiddish, what's a Jew to do? You know, what should one do? It's a very difficult situation. I mean, I'm an anti-Zionist, but that doesn't mean I don't have conflicts about Israel. Personal. It's difficult having this conversation. I couldn't really have this with somebody who's not Jewish. I was asked to be the voiceover for a film interviewing dissenting Israelis. And in the end, I turned it down because I felt I couldn't be party to a film like that that was being made by a non-Jew.
It's interesting. Mm-hmm. Yes.
You understand what I'm saying?
Of course, I grew up in the middle of Manhattan and had fairly secular parents who were more interested in being American, what they thought of as being American, than of being Jews. Mm-hmm. A kind of post-religious, post-ethnic consciousness. And many of the people that I knew as a kid had that outlook. So I was, of course, aware of being a Jew, but I had no connection with Jewish institutions. And to the extent I was influenced by the other non-Zionist type of Jewish tradition of concern with justice, the prophets, you know, the Old Testament, the good side of the Old Testament, mm-hmm. so to speak. And to me, that was much more resonant than the idea of establishing an ethnic state. I always had trouble with as a concept. And then the more I learned about it, the degree to which it was a state achieved by the dispossession mm-hmm. of long resident people, mixed up with colonial ambitions that Britain had after World War I, all of these things made me fairly clear in my sense that what was important in relation to the Israel-Palestine conflict was it working it out in a way that was humanly sensitive to both peoples.
The Edward Said vision, yes. Too.
He was a close friend of mine, and undoubtedly I was influenced. I stayed away from this issue for many years because I knew it was the third rail of American politics, and I thought it would unduly make my life more complicated and difficult.
Which it did. You didn't think you'd be in...
No, I didn't.
In jail.
I was listed by the Wiesenthal Center here in L.A. as the third most dangerous anti-Semite in the world. And the two ahead of me were the Supreme Guide of Iran and the Prime Minister of Turkey. So you made me feel at least I was doing something.
Well, let's talk about that. That was during your tenure with the United Nations. So how do you think of it now in retrospect? Was it worth 6 years of your life, or was it really, really worth a lot more, or something like that is the question. I don't know.
Well, there are several things to say. One is that it is very important as the only really authentic Palestinian voice in these global settings, and particularly to counter the degree to which the discourse is shaped by the U.S. and Israel on an international level. Secondly, I think if you use it in a way that is intended, that is, as being a witness to be able to report truthfully on the actual circumstances that are being experienced by the Palestinians living under occupation for such an extended period with no end in sight, I tried during my term there to call attention to the uniqueness of this experience of prolonged occupation for which the international law framework was never intended. It was intended for something very short term, not a quasi-permanent framework in which occupation becomes a form of creeping annexation. Mm-hmm. And also, as you earlier said, it rests on an increasingly apartheid structure mm-hmm. of administration, where there's one law for the settlers and another law for those that are resident in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. And I was able to influence the discourse within the UN at any rate, to talk about things like apartheid and annexation and ethnic cleansing in East Jerusalem, until I think my period there, that kind of more illuminating language was not acceptable. I think I did have an impact in normalizing it. And that, of course, is what part of what made Israel and the Zionist NGOs so furious with me and sought to have me removed from the position and exerted pressure on me to resign and so on, which the U.S. representatives, some of whom I knew, joined in that. And often when I gave my reports in the UN General Assembly meetings in New York or in Geneva, the Human Rights Council meetings, they would come to me afterwards and say, you know, we were instructed to say what we did. This isn't our real feeling.
Mm-hmm. The expanded, what I think you call the expanded definition of anti-Semitism that the State Department laid down, was that during your tenure?
I don't think the definition was formally accepted until fairly recently, I think last year or something. Mm-hmm.
That it's basically equating criticism of Israel with hate speech.
Yes, form of hate speech.
A form of hate speech, yeah. Strengthening this idea of the special relationship and that Israel is doing nothing wrong and must be protected at all costs.
Yes, and from an American point of view, I think not only the Israeli special relationship, but the Saudi Arabian special relationship are extremely harmful, both to the region and actually to the way in which U.S. foreign policy is carried out. They're very unfortunate kinds of deliberate suppression of any kind of perception that is critical of the partner in the special relationship. The situation with Saudi Arabia is in some ways almost inexplicable. Mm. The Israeli relationship can at least be explained rationally and coherently, but the Saudi Arabian one poured billions of dollars of support of jihadi extremism mm. is almost beyond my capacity to comprehend if you exclude oil, I guess. The special relationship is intact, in mm-hmm. my view. And because they went against Israel on the Iran agreement there mm. by giving more military...
Yeah. They now owe Israel more.
Yes.
But you have no more influence now, left over from being the rapporteur.
The reason I was so frequently attacked was because of the role in the UN, and not having that role makes me just one of many Jewish voices critical of Israel. Now there are a lot of Jews here and in Europe that are very critical of Israel.
So what are you working on now?
Well, a couple of things. I have just published a book of poems, actually, under the title Waiting for Rainbows. And then I'm trying to put together some longer, more academic writing on the Middle East and on Palestine. I'm not teaching these days, but I'm actively connected with the University of California here in Santa Barbara. We obviously share a great deal in our understanding of what's happened and what unfortunately is likely to continue to happen.
Really, I've loved this discussion. Thank you very much, Richard Falk. I'm very grateful to have had this conversation with you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
You heard Richard Falk talking about his experiences as UN Special Rapporteur on Palestine and on the special relationship between Israel and the United States. Tidings is archived at hazelkahn.com and produced by Tony Ernst.